I just don't think men are given the tools. I've always had a verbal acumen. I've always been emotionally aware. But as far as the men go, I would say leading by example. Sometimes when it comes to the emotional realm, a lot of men feel like they got to leave their man stuff aside to belong. In other words, sometimes sharing your emotions feels feminine. And that's just straight up bullshit. Forgive my language, but deserve strong language because a lot of men are suffering in silence.
Hello, you are listening to NPE Stories. This is a podcast where NPEs can share their story. I am your host, Lily, and I found out I was an NPE through an ancestry DNA test that changed my life forever. NPE is a term that stands for not parent expected or non-paternal event. This means that one or more of our parents are not who we believe them to be. NPE Stories is a podcast where NPEs can share their story of what their original family was like, how they found out they were an NPE, and what their journey has been like since the day they found out. Welcome to episode 187, and today I am speaking with AJ. Hi, AJ.
Hi. Thank you for having me.
Thank you so much for doing this. I know you did share your story about a year ago. What podcast was that on?
It was on Missing Pieces, This NPE Life, with my friend Don. And that's available, I believe, anywhere podcasts are available. But yes, Missing Pieces. It was a great time to share my story there.
Don Anderson is a good friend of mine. I will link that episode down below. And have new developments happened since in that last year?
Oh yeah, yeah. There's been more. Yeah, along the journey for sure.
Right. I actually did start reading a bit of your email and reading a little bit about your story. And so I'm really interested to hear your life story, I guess we'll call it. I really see a lot of similarities, especially with our ethnicities.
Oh, so really?
Yes. We'll get to that point. But
Okay.
But let's go ahead and start in, where do you want to start? Do you want to start in the beginning? Talk about your family of origin?
Sure. Yeah, that's where we want to start. Well, I was born in Rochester, New York. Yeah, this is tough because, you know, a lot of it is my story itself has been so muddled, revised throughout the years. But so I was born in Rochester, New York, but apparently I was born into a tumultuous situation between my mom and dad because here's what I know. When I was about 2 years old, I ended up way in the North Country of New York, having left Rochester with my dad. And so it's very muddled what happened at that time. But if I were to have to summarize, I guess I would say that there came a time when my mother said she needed a break. And I was 6 months old. My brother was 2 years old. And at 6 months old, she left for 2 weeks, air quotes, and never came back. Oh. And as it turns out, what had happened was I believe she was struggling with some addiction issues, but she also got involved with some aspects of the mafia in Rochester. She was full-blooded Sicilian. In fact, I heard she spoke three different dialects of Italian, and that opened up that whole world to her and closed that world to my dad. And all I know is 2 years later, I was up in very, very far north in New York, 15 minutes from the Canadian border, in fact, and basically starting a whole new life, you know, away from there with just my dad, my brother, and myself.
That's so heartbreaking. I can't imagine leaving a six-month-old baby and a two-year-old.
You know, I do wonder about that, man. And I started taking steps toward my mental health a few years ago, just seeing a therapist, you know, weekly. What I learned was, for me, I have problems with women. Clearly, I have some issues trusting women and you know, some abandonment, things like this, some common sense things. But I guess I never really. The problem is too, is I never really faced that. You know, my therapist asked me a few weeks ago. He goes, I mean, I'm 44 years old now. And he asks me, he goes, what would you say to your mother if she was here? And I'm like, I never thought about that question. Yeah, so you're right. I mean, I can't imagine what would have, you know, propelled her to do that. I, in very non-stereotypical fashion, I'm a stay-at-home dad. I have an 11-year-old and an 8-year-old, and I have stayed with them since they since they were born. My wife is a teacher. And so every day she gets in the car and she leaves. And it's me here with these kids. And we even home educate. We have since day one, long before the pandemic. And not for any weird reasons or anything like that. It's just what I felt was best. And by the way, they're like 2-3 grades ahead now. So it is working. Wow. And they're not weird little social. You know, when you think about homeschool, you're like, oh, they're going to be social weirdos. I'm like, the only reason homeschool kids have social weirdos is because their parents are social weirdos. That's the reality there. Well, I'm somewhat kidding about that. Being that I stay home, you know, with my kids are, this is so cliche, but you might not hear from a guy too often, but my kids are like the center of everything. Like, you know what I mean? I'm not judging any other parent out there. I'm not. But like, for me, you know, having children and doing it right is a death to yourself. Mm-hmm. Like, nobody cares what AJ wants because the baby's crying. Nobody cares if AJ wants to watch a movie. You know, these kids need me. And that was a hard process for me to transition into as a dad. But looking back, yeah, what a contrast to the experience I had with my mother. Really? That's not to say I don't have sympathy for her because, you know what I mean? Clearly, some addiction issues. I come to find out things later. Well, I'll tell it straight up. My grandmother stayed in my life. So my little Sicilian grandmother stayed in my life. And that was quite awkward because I don't think I ever saw my mother again. I may have seen her once or twice after the 6 months. Apparently there was a visitation thing here or there. And I have vague memories of that, almost like a dream. But my grandmother stayed in my life and I saw her quite a bit. She would drive from Rochester like, you know, 4 times a year. And I come to find out talking to my grandmother that my mother wasn't wanted. She was born 10 years after her other siblings. She was born in the middle of a divorce between my grandmother and my grandfather. My mother was not wanted, and I'm not sure she was loved very well. Mm-hmm. And so here's the thing. You know, if part of one aspect of my job is I do sit down and do family counseling and marital counseling. And, you know, what I always say when it comes to this stuff is, you know, they're not excuses, but there are some reasons. You know what I'm saying? Like, I'm not excusing this behavior, but it does help to figure out some reasons.
Yep.
You know, and another thing I always say too, when I'm helping folks is I say, you know, it's important that we love the real version of our parents, especially not the idealized versions we create of them. Because here's the thing, that's not truly loving them at all. The way we truly love them is by acknowledging their shortcomings, their triumphs, their failures, by truly seeing them and accepting them for who they are and then loving them. And you'd be shocked how hard that actually is. Because a lot of people, especially men, we don't want to see our dads as weak. We don't want to see our moms as flawed. You know, protect these images we create. But the problem is, and me, I've got to, you know, I'm a pastor, okay? I'm just going to put it out there. I frame everything through the Bible, God, that stuff. And the charge to love one another, in my opinion, is to love authentically, not these versions we've created. And so, you know, when I see my mom and I call her mom, isn't that interesting? When I look at, you know, in my mind's eye of all the things that I didn't get, you know, a hug from my mother, my wedding, my children, like anything from her, you know, have to honestly face this very flawed and hurting person. But I also have to, you know, feel my feelings and process through that stuff too. You know, there is blame and it lays in certain places. So I find that to be a more holistic view of our complexities, you know what I mean? Of these situations. Mm-hmm. You know, something I didn't talk about and never have talked about, it actually slipped out of me in my last sermon, believe it or not. Isn't it crazy? Like Freud was onto something here and there. I like to preach very practical things too, you know, and I was talking about our emotions and how we don't know how to, you know, process through emotions and things like this. And I was sharing a story of how one day my wife very innocuously was like, you know, you forgot your phone on the table. It's playing music. And then she's like, you're welcome. And she was kind of patronizing about it. My wife's very, you know, sweet and very even keeled, but it really triggered me. And I was like, oh, you know, and what I realized was like, that was touching on something, you know, already there inside of me. And one thing I found myself saying was, you know, it's not like I'm feeling a certain way because I felt like my wife said something almost patronizing, but it's the inner child in me going, I'm not going to be powerless again. I'm not going to be talked down to. I'm not going to be. And so he stands up, you know, and gets very defensive. And the problem is that also besides an inner child inside of me is a really big warrior, a big, strong warrior. And he jumps to the inner child's, jumps to his defense and says, you won't talk down to me, you know, cause I got big muscles and skills now. And I realized, I was like, you know, that's got to heal that wound. But one thing I found myself saying was, you know, my wife isn't going to abuse me, neglect me, or lock me in a closet. And dude, in front of all these people and recording online, because all the sermons go online, I forgot that my mother used to lock us in closets. Like, apparently, and it was a story that my stepmother told us, you know, quite a bit, but I forgot. Like, if my mother wanted to go do stuff and she was watching us, apparently she's just put us in a closet. Mm. I know. Like, I'm hearing it. I'd forgotten all about this for all these years. We're talking this last week. I mentioned it and I went, oh, might be some work to do there.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, it was pretty tumultuous. It was pretty bad. Apparently she was pretty messed up.
Oh, I'm so sorry.
Well, thank you for saying that. Yeah. So my dad, you know, moves us up here because he met this girl in Rochester and she moved back to the North Country and said, and they were apart and they were trying to date or whatever. And apparently my dad was taking care of me and my brother sleeping on a couch with a friend in a townhouse. And it just wasn't a good situation. My grandmother, by the way, my Sicilian grandmother and whatever, was taking care of me too. But all of a sudden this woman said, hey, if you want to come up here and bring the kids, you know, we can give it a go. And so that's how I ended up far north in the North Country and with my dad and this woman. And she later married my dad a few years later. So she was my stepmom. And I usually refer to her as mom or ma. Not like, in other words, it might get confusing and I'll try to try to keep it straight. But so we moved up here. A couple things of note that took place that weren't helpful was all of a sudden we weren't allowed to talk about my mother. We weren't allowed to ask about her. We weren't allowed to talk about her. And even when my grandmother and my cousin came up, they were not allowed to talk about her. Mm. It was really strange. I just remember it being really strange. And I remember like my stepmother getting very upset, you know? And so we just didn't. You just didn't talk about her. And then my cousin told me years later, who was one of my favorite people, by the way, she's so such a sweetheart. She told me years later that one day she mentioned my mother when visiting us up here, and my stepmother kicked her out of the house, said, you guys need to leave.
Oh my gosh.
I know. And I distinctly remember too, my brother having some behavioral issues. He's a good kid, but, and so the school that we were going to said, hey, we'd like to enroll him in Banana Splits. It's a group we have for kids from broken homes. And my stepmother got a hold of them and said, do not ever contact us again. I am his mother. He has his parents, and like shut it down. Years later, I asked my stepmother about this and she just was like, oh, I was doing the best I could at the time. And I was like, what makes you think that denying him a resource that could have helped him, you know? So that was the climate, you know, and that's what happened. Now, otherwise, you know, we did have a decent home and school. I played sports. I was very musical. I realize that music was where I started to get, you know, some of my needs met. I just have a natural talent. I'm a really good singer. I always have been. So at 8 years old, my chorus teacher said, hey, there's off-Broadway theater down, you know, in our townish. Like, you should enroll this kid. I mean, he's talented. And sure enough, not enroll the kid. He had to audition, clearly. Well, every time I auditioned, I got cast. And so I did summer stock off-Broadway theater for 4 years in a row, 8, 9, 10, 11, and really excelled. I found where I don't want to say fit in, but I found where my talents and attention would be, you know, and so by the end of the fourth year, I was actually cast as the Artful Dodger in Oliver, and I was acting next to soap opera stars, you know, Broadway folks, and, you know, having a lot of success. It was easy. You know, I could sing, I could dance. It just was what it was. And I was no stranger to working hard. I was actually asked at the end of that performance, I was asked to go audition for the final round of callbacks for Les Mis on Broadway.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. My choreographer, Tracy Brigden, was partners with Tony Randall at the time, Tony Randall Theater running Les Mis. And the character, the actor, had aged out of the role. And it was the one kid who has a singing and speaking part. And of course, you know, if you're like 12-ish, your voice is going to change. And so she's like, AJ, you should come to New York. I mean, you know, I've never worked with these other kids we have left, but I've worked with you. In other words, wink, wink. But my parents didn't want me to do that, so I did not go. Yeah, and so growing up I was popular, I was athletic, I was musical, and yet I don't know, man. Don's podcast is so titled so well; it's missing pieces. Mm-hmm. And for me, though, where my story diverges off some of the more typical that you hear, kind of, is all my missing pieces I always attributed to not having my mother in my life. You know, that feeling of not fitting in, not belonging, and just, I don't know, that's itch you can't scratch. I mean, listeners probably associate with this, especially in hindsight. I was just attributed to, I don't have my mother, you know. And again, her being full-blooded Sicilian, I grew up thinking, no, I'm half Italian, and I'm growing. And all the people up here are French. We're right near Canada, so they're French. They're English. They're Irish. There was no Italians around here at all. And so I just thought, well, that's what it is. You know, I'm half Italian, and I don't know my mom. And so I just kind of plugged along. Like I said, school was fine. It was easy. Went to high school. That was fine. You know, friends, whatever. But I did have this weird. I always thought I just had a high attention need. But looking back, you know, I guess it all fits in and makes sense. In other words, so I was the prom king. You know, I was, like I said, popular, blah, 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 blah. But I never even noticed that. Like, I never even really noticed any of that. It was like I was looking for something else the whole time. Mm-hmm. And it's not like, you know, everything wasn't enough. I didn't pay attention. I had a cousin who I was really close to, and she felt very invisible in high school. And I don't know, picked her up and gave her rides, and she was my cousin and my friend. And I never even noticed that I was in one group and she feels like she was in another. I never even noticed, because she was just, that's my girl. That's my cousin, you know? And I just was so focused on moving forward. And I picked up a guitar at 16 and taught myself how to play because I wanted to sing. And I immediately started doing that. And music was where I looked for my validation and attention, acceptance and approval. I hit the ground running. I went off to college. I was the first one in my family to go to college. College was easy too. Did well academically, even though I refused to buy textbooks because they were super expensive. And so I grew up in a house though where everybody worried about money all the time. And I remember as a kid, I would stress about money, even when I was years old, stress about my parents talking about money. And my first prayers to a God I did not know were like, Lord, please protect our house and our kitties and doggies, and please help nothing to break. And so that carried on too, where, like I said, I didn't even buy textbooks in college because I was cheap. I mean, I did well, but the first thing I did was find this guy who could play guitar, and we formed a band and we hit the ground running. That summer we ended up down in Virginia Beach gigging at where Dave Matthews became famous. The following summer we had an exchange student from England come. And so he's like, why don't you come to England and get some gigs? So we toured all summer in England over there. And like, all of a sudden music became, you know, the thing. And of course we wrote all original music and we, you know, produced and things like this. And all the while, you know, looking back, because I no longer pursue the music industry at all. Looking back, what I realized was, I'll set the scene. So we played the Cavern Club where the Beatles became famous. We headlined there a couple times, and that was a big deal. And so standing on stage, I'm the lead singer, you know, playing guitar, and I got this whole band around me and the crowd's out there and we're doing really well. And I just remember like just this moment of clarity where it was like strumming the guitar, singing my heart out. And all I was really asking people was like, am I enough? Like, is this enough? Am I enough? And when I come to find, you know, when you're pursuing that question with either work or hobbies, or it just becomes this bottomless pit. And I really realized that my final tour of England after college, I did all 4 years of college, graduated college, moved out to Colorado. I was actually going to go to a Bible college, and that didn't work out. My priorities were starting to shift at that time. But then basically everything fell apart for me. Like, my 5-year girlfriend and I broke up, and I broke up the band and blah, blah, blah. But then went back to England as a singer-songwriter and did a couple years there. And that's when I really started to examine, you know, what I was doing and why I was doing it. And I kind of think it all kind of came back to, you know, some of the stuff. And I always attributed it to the mother. So now we're at a chapter 2 of the story, which is to say, at 25, 26, I come back from England, could not go back to England because of their immigration policies. They're quite staunch. A lot of Americans don't know that, but other countries' borders are not what we think they are. I could not go back, even though I had a sponsor and everything else. And so I ended up back at my dad and stepmom's house, 25, 26 years old, college degree, no girlfriend, no car, no job, no nothing. And I end up back, I want to say here in the North Country, because I am in the North Country now. And I got a job at a radio station because I had a degree in media with an audio engineering. And I start doing, you know, weekend board operating and DJ work. And at that time, all of a sudden my dad got sick and he got real thin and we didn't know what was going on with him. He attributed it to a new diet he was on or something. Never, not that he was ever big, but he was getting too skinny. And when they checked up on him, it was throat cancer. And so here I was, 25, 26, and feeling pretty bad about myself and my life and my prospects. And all of a sudden, our priorities changed because dad was sick. And dad was my best friend. I had a good friend named Pete at the time, but dad and I were close. We're very dissimilar people. We were not very alike at all. But, you know, I always thought I was like my mother. But Dad and I, you know, like we were good. Like we were solid. And remember when I told you, I said earlier in the podcast, I said, loving people authentically. I had begun a program at the time, which was like a Christian counseling program, which I literally facilitate to this day, 16 years later, except I sit on the other end of the couch, you know, but that really, at that time, Dad was sick. And that's when I really started to face him. Can I go off on a thing real quick that might help folks? Okay. So I have this weird cockamamie theory. Now it might be absolute BS because I came up with it, but I have this theory, and I'll borrow from Carl Jung. I'll borrow from Jordan Peterson a little bit here and say, I find that we all have to bury and resurrect our parents. And here's what I mean by that, particularly men in my office. There's so many men in this world. Oh, I hope there's some men listening because this is really helpful. There's so many men in this world. We have no rites of passage. Women, you guys have one where you go, oh, I'm kind of a woman now. Men don't have it at all. And so when we talk to our men and we go, get off the couch, get out of your parents' basement, you're a man. And they go, when did that happen? What are you talking about? And all society is like, be a man. And they're like, who are you talking to? And so what ends up happening with this no rites of passage and no real tribe, like every other culture has these, lots of cultures have these, you end up with a bunch of men with, you know, facial hair and big trucks and maybe some deep voices. And they metaphorically, you know, they walk into the cave and they see this lion laying there. And they're like, now that's a man. That's a full grown male lion. Now, I'm making a metaphor here that the human, you know, becomes the lion. So you'll see why in a minute. So, you know, like the Lion King, right? Every man sees their father and goes, now that's a man. They look in the mirror and lots of people don't see a man. You know what I mean? Like literally, go ask your husband, hey, when did you become a man? He's probably not going to pull a date out of his pocket. He'll go, oh, and actually when asked, lots of people, they go, when does a boy become a man? They'll go, when he gets married, when he has a kid, when he has a good job. These are all kind of arbitrary, not healthy things, by the way. I would not want my son to wait to become a man to the day he gets married. Because his wife deserves better than that. She deserves to know and be a fully matriculated man ahead of time. And doggone it, you better not be married and not be a man and then have a kid. Like, come on. And so long story short, we have is a lot of people who they walk over, they go, that's a man. Now, the rest of the world we see, going back to the lion metaphor, we look at these men and we go, that's a male lion. And he goes, no, that over there is. And the problem with that is, number one, no rites of passage and things like this for men or women. I'm not excluding women here. But number two, the problem we have there is if we as women are always looking at mom and go, now that's a woman, that's the woman, that's the standard, and we will wait and we will take subconsciously, in my opinion, remember, this might all be BS, I just came up with it, but we might subconsciously stay in a subjugated place where we're not coming into our own because we're waiting to turn into that other person or waiting to hit their level. And so the burying part is this, the way you're able to do this, now this is why nobody wants to do it, by the way. I'll spare the theatrics here, but you will end up doing this. If like you're hearing me right now and people are like, this doesn't sound good. You will end up doing this because here's the thing. The burying of the parents, I'm talking about metaphoric, right? But if you do not do that where you face them and, you know, and you kind of put them under the water and examine them for who they truly are, that's the burying process I come up with here. You will eventually have to do that when you actually do say goodbye to them. You know, clearly in my job, I do funerals all the time. And the problem is, if you haven't done this already, you will do it on that day. In other words, if we don't face who they are and truly see them and truly accept them, shortcoming, you know what I mean? Like, you know, hey, Dad, you're brave and strong and smart, but you're kind of an asshole. Or you're kind of, you know, impatient at times. If we put up blinders to either the good or the bad, the problem is it's gonna face us later on. And like I said, usually when they're gone. That's the moment when you're faced with who are they or who were they. Okay. I hope I'm making sense here. I really do. Mm-hmm. Am I making sense?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
The reason I bring this, okay, let me come to a conclusion here. Why is this important? I'll tell you why it's important. Because the things that we refuse to see about our parents, we'll refuse to see about ourselves. I remember one day my dad, remember we're 25, I'm facing my dad. He's sick. This is all part of the story here. Remember one day I walk in and Dad, the old phones, right? Landlines. Remember if you'd slam it and give you a nice satisfying ding? If you hit it hard enough, do you remember that? Well, I walk in and he was getting off the phone with somebody. And he's blah, 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 and ding, he slams the phone. I go, Dad, what's going on? What's wrong? And he goes, I don't know. And I was like, number one, God bless you for your honesty. And number two, wow, you know, like you're 58 years old right now and you don't have the emotional wherewithal to describe your feelings. Now, here's the thing, ready? I have to accept that. That's who he is. And so God bless it. I really am grateful to God. For 25 years old, I underwent this. I said, I'm going to bury this man. metaphorically, which is to say, everything he is, I'm going to put it all together and I'm going to put it underneath. And then in that moment, when you truly face who they are, then you're left with the decision to resurrect them, which is to say this: I accept you for who you truly are. Now, do I choose to love you? That's the burying and resurrecting process that we all have to go through with our parents, to see them for who they are and then either choose to or choose not to love them. And by the way, that can be done in different places. Somebody needs to hear this. You can love someone from afar. You can love someone from a closed door. The way I say it. Yeah. Right, Lily?
That's what I was just going to ask. I was like, can you love them from a distance?
Oh, listen, here's my Christian saying. Ready? You can close the door. I just don't think you're allowed to lock it.
Yep.
Which is to say this. And again, that's with the Christian framework. If someone's in my office going, you know, dad's toxic and stuff like this, it's like, you could absolutely close the door, love them from far away. Nobody says bang your head against a toxic person. But, you know, again, from a Christian framework, leave some room for repentance, potentially, and forgiveness, potentially, for you, by the way. So yeah, by no means, man, that's one thing the church has done really poorly. And I never want to represent any church or denomination or group like that. But yeah, this staying toxic, staying abusive, by no means. I mean, I'll tell a story a little later about how I had to do this with my stepmom. I didn't talk to her for a year and a half because I was setting up boundaries for my own well-being. Did I still love her? Yes, I did not let hatred fill my heart or unforgiveness, but loving her meant she needs to stay over there. Mm-hmm. That needs to be okay. I mean, really. And I'm saying that with the authority that I have in my position too, that I believe that's a godly thing. I don't believe God's telling you to keep getting your face punched in or your emotions trampled on, but do you let your heart become hardened and bitter? Can I tell you something? For you, you should not, for your own good. You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
So that's what happened at 25. I was fortunate enough to face my dad. And then all of a sudden, chapter 3, there had been rumors that my birth mother wasn't doing well. Now, I had heard that she was in and out of jail, but again, we weren't allowed to talk about her even when I was in my 20s. And I heard she was in and out of jail, and I heard she wasn't well. In fact, I heard about that in England when I was still over there before I came. And one of the reasons I wanted to come was potentially to I don't know what. I don't know what I wanted to do, but I guess I wanted to be back stateside. She apparently was in Florida. I'm in New York. And then one day, my Sicilian grandma, called my house and my mother had died. And I didn't get to see her. I didn't get to talk to her. And yeah, in retrospect, that is a regret I have. I have forgiven myself for that. You know, I felt the feelings and I've forgiven myself for that. But if I could go back, I would have changed that. I would have met her. I would have done whatever I needed to do to meet her, because meeting her would have been meeting part of myself.
How did you feel about your mom never reaching out to you before she passed away?
Conflicted, because there was a lot of different stories. There's one story I didn't share. I remember one day she called when I was like 6 years old. And my parents were out bowling. And I remember my brother grabbed the phone and just started bawling, I miss you and all this stuff. And I remember just feeling so angry. And at 6 years old, I ran over, I ripped the phone out of his hand. And I yelled into the phone like, don't ever call here again. You're not supposed to call here. And I hung up the phone. And looking back with an adult brain, it's all conditioning. You know, what kid doesn't want to hear from their mother?
Yeah.
But that my mother had become the monster, you know, because of all the stories. But in other words, I think she didn't feel safe doing so.
Yeah.
In fact, my cousin, whom I love, used to tell me, you know, we were told you had this great family, that your stepmom was amazing and that, you know, you had your dad. So everybody told your mother to stay away. You know, you can't care for them. Let them have a good life. And that's what she was going on. And so, yeah, I kind of knew that. And so didn't get angry about her not reaching out. I understood that there was a lot of interference. And so after she died, I went down to my grandma's place in Rochester to help her. I was close with my grandma. Like I said, grandma was, she was bereaved quite a bit. She was distraught. But in that time period was a time when I learned a lot of truths I didn't know about what kind of what really had happened in Rochester, that my dad was struggling with his own addiction to alcohol, and that things were really tumultuous and not healthy between my mother and my dad. And my grandmother had to, you know, pay our light bill here and there. And so I was always told that my mother was a monster. She was always the monster under the bed or the monster in the closet. And then I come to find out at 25, my dad had his own blame to bear. And that challenged me. I came back from Rochester You know, this is right before Dad got sick, but I came back from Rochester and the things really shuffled between me and Dad, where I had to face more things about him I didn't know. And I did. I faced those things and chose to love him through them. And like I said, then he got sick. Life's priorities came, you know how it, I'm sure lots of folks know, you know, when somebody in the family's sick, it becomes the pinnacle. This is what we're doing. Nothing else matters. And I remember caring for the home and, you know, the lawn and stuff. And my stepmother and I did not get along. I've kind of left that part low. We should probably talk about that. But at one point she tried to kick me out of the house and I simply said, no. I said, you can try to move me. Like, I don't know what to tell you. My dad needs help. I don't care. You know, get out of my face. And that was it, you know, taking care of Dad. And he had finished his last chemo and radiation and things were looking good. And, you know, so Sunday came around. Sunday was Father's Day. And that Tuesday morning, he passed away in his sleep. Very suddenly to us, because we had this plan for healing and the doctors were confident. He just did his last radiation and then he dies. And that was, if you actually were to ask me, hey, AJ, when did you become a man? I would tell you it would be June 20th, 2006. That was the day when putzing around with these dreams of becoming a musician and, you know, worrying about the stuff of childhood, it ended because Dad died. And we had a house to take care of. And I felt responsibility to take care of my stepmom. And all of a sudden it was like, I mean, not to be too dramatic, but this is honestly what happened. I remember brushing my teeth. We had double sinks. And I remember brushing my teeth that night, looking in the mirror. And I had done that the night before because I stayed up late playing video games or some stupid shit, you know. And I remember brushing my teeth the night before, Monday night, and just going like, I'm lost. What am I doing in this world? And feeling sorry for myself. Well, you know, 24 hours later, I was brushing my teeth after the longest day of my life. And I remember looking at myself just going, well, judging myself quite a bit. You know, how weak and pathetic are you and how childish are you? But I remember at the end of it going, well, that those days are done, man. Those days are done. And they were. I went out and got a job bagging groceries, just the first job I could get, you know. Bagging groceries and yes, sir, yes, ma'am. And I'm still working at the radio station. And I was giving my stepmom my paycheck at the time to take care of her. And that was a tough time. It was a really tough time.
I'm so sorry.
Thank you. Thank you for saying that. Okay. So one of the things that I think is important to talk about is the environment of the childhood. And even into that, you know, part where Dad died when I was 26 was, you know, my stepmom, she did her best. You know, she did, but she's just not a very maternal person, warm, blah, blah, blah. You know, so it was very contemptuous. I started getting into looking at my mental health. One of the questionnaires said, like, mom is or whatever. And I wrote my worst enemy. I mean, I, you know, loved her in so many ways and I hated her so much too. She was emotionally abusive. She was physically abusive at times. It was a bad situation. And, you know, in retrospect, nobody knew. My family didn't know. They thought, it, you know, this wonderful veneer of who she was. And anyway, so that was the environment there.
Just out of curiosity, did she ever have any biological children of her own?
Great question, Lily. No. Interestingly enough, she was not able to. I remember when I was, you know, maybe 10 years old, 12 years old, she actually had a hysterectomy. She had some sort of condition where she was never able to birth children.
Okay.
So yeah. So it kind of seems like a good situation though, right? I mean, she gets these two kids and we get a stepmom. It's just unfortunate that some people aren't, you know, necessarily born to be parents. Mm-hmm. And that's what I see. And I hope you're hearing that theme of, I accept her and see this honestly, you know, yeah. I'm not making excuses for her. I've worked through this stuff, but yeah, that was the situation. And so getting to the NPE stuff, which, isn't it funny, we're not even there yet this far in. Apologies. did always, like I said, everything got attributed to the fact that I didn't know my mother. I was athletic and I was built a certain way. And I never, you know, one thing that bothered me growing up was my dad and my brother, very similar people. I mean, very similar personalities. They look so similar. And I just remember, you know, as a kid, like I've always had well-defined muscles. I was accused of being on steroids in ninth grade. Like I just built that way. Just ripped since I was a kid, you know? And I was always looking around and it was nowhere around me. And, you know, Dad's legs and Nick's legs looked the same. They're calf muscles and mine were high. And I don't know. In retrospect, yeah, there was something underneath. There was a need that I don't know if Alice Miller would call this mirroring, But I had no mirrors to look in retrospect. And I just kept looking at Dad, wanting to see parts of me and Dad and me. And I just weren't there. And I just felt sad about that, thinking, oh, I'm just too much like my mother. And so, you know, that kind of stunk. But so I'm going to fast forward a little bit. So my father passes away. A year later, I meet this woman. And I shouldn't say it that way. She becomes my wife. I meet this woman. Oh, I did. A year later, wife, and we married a year later. So moved in with her on our wedding night. And that's the first time I ever felt peace. I was carrying her across the threshold and waking up to, she's a very opposite of me. I'm so conflict oriented and I'm so hyper vigilant, and she does not like conflict, you know, and so we created this home. This I could cry about, honestly. I could get teared up about this, is the beauty and wonder that became my life for the first time. And her name is Melanie. She'll never know. I mean, God used her to provide for me in such a big way, not just the home, because she already owned her own home. She had a great job. Like, she was just so put together. The first thing I ever felt for her was respect, but, which is big, by the way, because think about my trauma, like trust for women, you know, abandonment and all these things. But Melanie, when I met her, like, I respected her and I trusted her like right away. And that period of my life, I remember being in the backyard. We lived in the village, just this little patch of grass. And I remember grilling, looking at the house and just praying and going, Lord, I'm so grateful. Look, we have a home. We have a house. Like, this is crazy. Like, I never lost that luster for what we had. I never, you know what I mean? I just was like, we have a garage. Like, this is great. Because this was the first time I wasn't fighting for my life all the time. And that's being dramatic, but I mean, emotionally, I wasn't arguing and fighting all the time with someone and being called names and being put down. It's just like, come home from work and just like be. Those were good days, man. Those were really good days. They've all been good days since then, honestly. Years go by and we're looking at having children, and we had a couple false starts and some heartbreaks to begin with. But then, you know, we were blessed, so blessed with my son and then my daughter 2 years later. And we moved out. I live in 165 acres out here, just woods, seclusion, and I love it. And but all of a sudden, my wife's brother had done 23andMe. And he's like, oh, hey, Uncle So-and-so did 23andMe. Why don't we look at the results? And I also noticed there was, like, you know, health stuff. And I was like, oh. Now, all my life, people have asked me, like, do you have any family history of? And I'd always go, I don't know, because I don't know my mother's side. Well, all of a sudden, I was like, well, I got kids now, so I got to, you know, I should probably fill in the blanks if I can. And they were running a sale, you know, 23andMe was 50% off. So kids got a big kick out of it. I spit in the tube, you know, and I sent it in, like, okay, guys, you're going to get the results. And well, this was pre-COVID. And so it was probably 2019. Results came fast. I guess it's gotten more popular because it only took like 3 weeks to get my results. I had downloaded the app on my phone. And one day I get an email, bing, your results are in. Open up the app. So I open up the app and I go, here we go. And the first thing it does is your ethnicity wheel. Right? With a color and a color and a color or something, with my picture in the center. And it says, AJ is 96% Italian and 4% Greek. And I went, what? And at that moment, Don from Missing Pieces, you know, he really, so he calls himself obsessed about that moment that we all had, because it is so surreal and so otherworldly and so absolutely impossible to explain. But that moment, I had talked to my cousin a week earlier, and I had this weird feeling for no good reason. But I was asking my cousin, who was like our family historian, I said, hey, you know, what's Dad's ethnicity? And he's like, oh, French and Ukrainian, blah, 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 blah. He told about prominent members of the family who, Dad was French and Ukrainian. He wasn't even a sneeze Italian. So I'm looking at my phone, and I'm 96% Italian, 4% Greek. Clearly, both my parents had to be full-blooded Italians. And I'm like, I can feel it right now in the pit of my stomach, just like, you know, the world comes crashing down, but also in super slow motion. My wife had gone to a doctor's appointment. It was summertime, so she was home from school, and I had the kids. And I had to just, like, shut it down, because I had to make breakfast for the kids and, you know, have life. Life had to move forward. And I would have burned the house down. You know, I would have stood at the stove staring at a pan that would have caught fire, you know. Where your brain is just like, wow. And that was the moment for me. And messaged Melanie, and I said, forget what I said. She goes, do you want me to come home? I said, no, finish your doctor's appointment. And she came home, and we just sat on the front steps, and I had held it together, you know, for the kids. we just sat on the front steps and I just cried and I put my head on her shoulder and just bawled. My one connection to who I was my dad. And that wasn't even real biologically. And I'm like, I didn't have a foot in either camp. I had no idea who I was in that moment. I couldn't fall back on half of my biology because I'd never known that one. And that just, that was something, man. That was really something. But you know, the strangest thing in that moment was I also felt this weird sliver of relief. And that is so, it's so in conflict with the rest of my feelings. And then if we weren't careful, we could even feel guilty about that. You know, I felt this sense of relief. And God bless my therapist at the time. I'd begun telehealth therapy, you know, a year earlier because of my issues with women and, you know, anxiety and stuff like this. I was finally facing those things. And God bless him. I messaged him and I said, hey, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, come on. He jumped right on and took me right then into a session. And we processed through some of the stuff. And he goes, at the end of the session, which was mostly me just crying, he goes, should I not have, you know, pushed you in that direction or encouraged you to find that? And I said, absolutely not. This would not change this. Even in this moment right now, where this is three hours old, I would not change this. And I think that came from a feeling of just finally connecting to like, this makes sense. Finally, this makes sense. I don't know why, and I don't have all the qualifiers or quantifiers, but it makes friggin' sense all of a sudden. And that's the part that I was like, no, I wouldn't undo this. And so that was good. That was good. What began though was a crappy season of when my mother had left at 6 months old, she had taken off with this guy named Tony. By the way, my name is Anthony. My real name is Anthony. She had taken off with this guy, Tony. Well, I had been told all my life that this guy was a dirtbag. And I was like, oh Lord, please don't let Tony be my father. Come on. Like, no. I found him on Facebook and he looks like a douchebag. And I was like, I don't want this dude to be my dad. And he has a kid and the kid kind of looked like me. And I'm like, no, come on. And that's what my family started to tell some folks. And somebody, my cousin said, like, I wonder, you know, we were wondering if it was Tony. I'm like, ah. But yeah, so that summarizes that moment, man. Hmm. You know what it did for me too, though, weirdly? My therapist says to me, he goes, where does this leave your stepmom? I said, nowhere. Nowhere. Who's she to me now? The guy I thought was my father's fourth wife? What the hell is that? I've been taking care of this woman all these years. You know what I'm saying? Dealing with her emotional abuse and toxicity and name calling and all that. I'm like, what do I owe her now? Who are you to me? And so that actually facilitated. We had a conversation where I called her. I called my cousin to try to be part of this and she blew me off. We were close at the time, but my stepmom on the phone, I'm like, this is what just happened. And she didn't believe it at first, you know, nah. And I'm like, science, you know, science. And she's like, yeah, they can get things. No, it's not wrong. Found it. Oh, it's not wrong. And within 20 minutes, she goes, but you know, you and I haven't really been close for a while now, and you have not been treating me well. And I finally was just like, I am not letting you make this about you. Mm-hmm. I'm not letting you make this about you. And I did what I wished everybody it would be able to do in this moment, which is to guard and protect my own rights to my hurt, to my emotion and my needs. And I did. I said, I'm not doing this. We're not. This is the hardest thing I've ever had to face beyond burying him. You know, at 26, I'm like, you're not going to make this about you. I don't give a shit how you feel. Like, that just has to be it. And at the end of that conversation, I said, you know, here's the thing. She said something like, what about us or something like that? And I said, here's the thing. I'm done owing you anything. All my life, you've said, you owe me. You owe me. She would throw it in our faces that, you know, I took you in. You owe me. You and your brother owe me. So finally, I said, you know what? I refuse to have a relationship with you based on obligation. After this right now, I got to figure out how to be a husband, how to be a father. I got to figure out how to survive this news. I'm not going to owe you. I said, so if you want to have a relationship based on mutual experiences, based on, you know, things that we have in common, I'm open to that, but I will not have a relationship with you based on obligation. And she basically said, no, she basically was like, I'm not interested. And I was like, cool, click. And I didn't speak to her again for a year and a half. And that's not to say I actively avoided her phone calls or stonewalled her. Like, no, you're not going to talk to me. I didn't do that. She didn't friggin' call. Christmases came and went. Like, she didn't reach out. I hadn't blocked her. I did nothing. She sent me a letter at one point, and the letter, postage, the letter just read, basically, blah, 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 you owe me. Don't mistreat me. And I fired back with nothing, nothing, because it didn't warrant my time. That's what I meant earlier about accepting someone and loving them, but choosing where they are in your life, the place that's going to work and it's going to be healthy. And I didn't just talk the talk. I walked the walk, dude, a year and a half. And she had a cardiac event, and my cousin called me, and I'm like, okay, don't know what to tell you. And a few months later, she's like, can we go out to lunch? And I said, yes, we always could have. My heart was open. I didn't let my heart become steel against you, but I'm doing what I need to do. So we did. We went out to lunch, and that's when I was able to basically talk through and let her know about some of the things in the past. Based around the NPE experience, but also between she and I, and set the boundaries and tell her, you know, certain things were unacceptable, certain things that were done and said. And, you know, and to be fair, you know, it's like I said before about, you know, closing a door, but not locking it. Lots of people aren't going to walk through that door. You know, I know that reality. Most people are not going to use a Christian term, repent. They're not going to change direction, you know, but this person did. And she related. I was able to finally say to her, like, when I said to her, like, why did you not let us talk about our mother? Why did you try to erase her and become her? Like, that, don't you understand where now I'm having problems relating to my wife? You know, like, you have to put a valve of your emotions when you're 8 years old. You have to be able to turn them on or off. Well, it doesn't always work. She heard some of that. And I said to her, I said, but, you know, here's the thing. You gave us something that she couldn't have. You gave us, you know, school clothes and normalcy. And I look at my mother, whom, you know, was apparently addicted and involved in some other, she couldn't have given us a stability. Mm-hmm. You know, if we'd have stayed there, that would have been, it wouldn't have worked, you know? So she and I have had a relationship since then, a much better relationship, actually. Holidays are fine. Like, I see her all the time. In fact, my wife and I just bought a home. My uncle passed away. We bought his home. It's on the water. And we're like, you know what? Let's go ahead and let her live there. And it'll be a better situation for her. So we actually ended up kind of buying her a house because it works out for everybody. But in other words, there's real forgiveness and there's real healing there that has taken place. Now, speaking of the NPE stuff, which I'm sorry, I, you know, so long-winded of the other stuff, but that then began the search of do I get to find my father? And the reality was I had no way of knowing because my dad was on my birth certificate. Nobody had any idea. And so through tremendous circumstance, crazy blessing, I got in touch with this man who was a DNA researcher on the side, just a dude. I think he was retired. And he's like, again, friend of a friend of a friend of a friend. He's like, yeah, I'll look into it. No promises, but yeah, $20 an hour. He says, you know, we'll figure it out. And he had gotten some triangulation, but there wasn't enough. So I went 6-8 months with, you know, maybe some hope, maybe not some hope. And then he hit a dead end. And he's like, there's nothing more I can do. When I was faced with the reality, I may never know who my father is. And so I tried to work on applying some acceptance there at that time. It was that at that time that my one of my DNA matches, my cousin, messaged me and she goes, hi, I'm so-and-so. How are we related? I was like, you tell me. I have no idea. And so she was like, oh, and she actually had a lot of compassion for me. She's a wonderful, wonderful, sweet woman. She found out that like, oh, you didn't know your mother either. Like everybody should have a mother. She's like, I want to help you. So she starts like asking everybody in our family, in that family, of course, our family, because she was my cousin, like, will you do this? You should spit in a cup. You should. Blah, blah, blah. And lots of people didn't want to, but she got real serious about it. And my DNA researcher was like, well, if anybody over in this branch over here does it, it's really going to help us narrow down. So my cousin went over and said to this person, hey, you need to do this. There's a guy out there who needs answers. And plus, you know, it's half off and blah, blah, blah. And he originally says no, and then the next day had a change of heart and did it. And 3, 4, 5 weeks later, bing, my researcher knew exactly who my father was. He's like, it can't be these people anymore. It's this person. And I was like, wow. So we did end up finding out who my father was. Unfortunately, he had passed away. He had died 9 years earlier, something like that. So I never got to meet my father, never got to meet my mother, but I do have two siblings. I do have two siblings from my father. Well, one of them, my brother, when he found out, there was a fight to get him to find out. His mother didn't want to tell them, but I was able to convince a friend of the family through some strong Italian convincing that he needed to tell that woman that you got to tell my siblings, give them a choice. They're grownups. They're 10 years older than I am. Well, my brother embraced me immediately, called me and goes, I hear we're brothers. and immediately had 3-hour conversation and entered in the honeymoon phase of sibling that many people talk about. My sister struggled a bit. My sister struggled mightily, in fact, with it, because what had happened was my father was split from his wife during the time I was conceived. And then they reconciled and finished the rest of their 45, 50 year marriage. But there was a dark spot in the center of it. Yay, that's me. Right? Like, hi, everyone. Remember that nightmare that was your 10 and 11 year? Hi. So she struggled with that. And she has a high profile job. She's out in the public eye, and that doesn't help. Just, you know, like every other person out in the public eye, she kind of has trust issues. But it was still been really, really awesome to meet, especially my brother and his family. So this was years ago now. And ever since I did Don's podcast, like, I've hung out with my brother and his family many more times. They live about 3 hours away. They were here this Christmas. It came up 2 days after Christmas, and we had an amazing day here. You know, 3-4 years later, we're out of the honeymoon phase, and this is just who we are now. And sure enough, his daughters are both full scholarship athletes, full scholarship D1 athletes, but they're kind and wonderful and sweet. My brother and his wife, we get along just so well. And I gotta say this, at least something happened meeting him. Something happened inside of me. And albeit it's something that I allowed to happen, but the way I can best describe this is, so years ago when I found out about him, he's like, why don't you come down? You know, we got a boat, blah, blah, blah. Well, I went alone. I drove 3 hours, dropped my kids and my wife at the in-laws, which is only 45 minutes away. And I went to meet them alone. And I met him in the driveway, you know, hugged him. And within a minute, 2 minutes, 3 minutes, we were just family. The weirdest thing, how do my therapists say? It's something that is profound. It's profound. There's another dude. I'm a dude. And like, we're brothers. Like, you know what I mean? Like, that's, I don't want to speak for guys here, but I'll speak for guys. We're not typically like that. You know what I mean? Like, meet some guy and he's got my trust and he's got my love. That's weird. But he did. And he's a hunter. He's a fisherman. You know, he's not a very emotionally expressive guy like I am, but you know, just masculine men. But all of a sudden we're like just family. It was the weirdest thing. And without crying, because I could definitely cry about this, sitting at the dining room table at his house that day, the day I met him, and his daughters are on the right side, him and his wife are on the left. He's got the photo albums because he thought I was all about, you know, wanting to see the photo albums and stuff like this, but I wasn't. I wanted to see him. I wanted to know him and my sister. I didn't care at that time so much about getting to know my father. I don't know why. But sitting there and just laughing, walls were just filled with laughter and love. That was the first friggin' time I feel like I've ever had that. And that's not to say there wasn't love in my home growing up, but there's a biological connection there. And yes, I grew up with, you know, a half brother next to me, but there's just, I don't know. I don't know what to tell you. There was something new there, and it was amazing. And the effect had, oh, so the next day I brought my kids, who were like 8 and 6 at the time, real fun age, you know, over there. And these girls are 10 years older, 16, 18, but they clicked. You know, my kids don't have cousins, essentially, in their lives, but they clicked. And like, they're laying on the hammock together and they're playing games and like, they're laughing and squealing and running. And it was like this thing inside of me that I never, you know, like this tender, amazing thing. And I put my arm around my brother and they took pictures. He's a little shorter than I am, which I love. I'm not a huge guy. I'm 5'10", 205, but I work out and stuff. But he's a little shorter than me, which I get a kick out of because he's older. But I had my arm around him and we're both in the picture just smiling to beat the band. And his daughter goes, Dad, I don't think I've ever seen you smile like that. Oh. I know. And then he says under his breath, he goes, I love you already, man. I'm glad we're not on video right now.
That's so sweet.
I know. And so this little orphan boy who never knew he was a friggin' orphan, his brother just embraces him. And I like them. That's the cool part. Like, I like them. Like, they're cool people. We come home. I talk to my therapist who's been with me for the journey, you know. He's like, well, how? He actually got teary about it. Like, and I was able to have such a profound moment of acceptance and love pretty much for the first time with some biology. And the weirdest thing happened after that, Lily. I stopped feeling so pulsed and compelled to like work out. I stopped feeling so compulsed and compelled to do. And that's what I realized was like a lot of the stuff that I was just doing, you know, a lot of, like, it's not a problem to work out. I still work out to this day, but like I realized lot of what I was doing was tied into value and worth. Like I was working out so that I would be approved of or that I'd cut above. And, you know, I'd want people to hear me sing because I'm a really good singer. And that all kind of went away the day I met my brother. And that's pretty freaking weird, but also makes a ton of sense. Because that's the day that all of a sudden I began, and I continued doing therapy and things like this too, but that's the day that I really feel like I found out, got comfortable finally with who I am. I've got the answers now. And another thing is like, I'm ashamed. I'm proud of who I am. You know, like, helps that I'm full-blooded something. You know what I'm saying? Oh, by the way, in an act of cruelty, 2 months after, 2 months after I got my first DNA results, 96% Italian, 4% Greek. You get this email. I get this email and it goes, hey, we're 23andMe. I'm sorry. It was Ancestry because I did both. Ancestry emails me and they're like, Anthony, we've updated your ethnicity or we've changed your ethnicity. I forget what it said. And I was like, like for a moment of cruelty, I was like, maybe it was a mistake. Maybe the whole thing. Nope, they updated it. AJ, you're not 96% Italian. You're 97% Italian. I was like, oh, thanks so much. Like, wow, I'm so glad you scared the life out of me with that email. But it helps to know that too, because there's a whole culture to embrace and parts of myself, which, I mean, you hear the way I talk. And I'm not saying this is just how I talk. I've always talked this way, even though I didn't grow up around Italian people. And it's like all my life, I felt bad about that. I felt guilty about that. I felt guilty about shade of my skin or, you know what I'm like, the thickness of my hair, all that stuff that comes from that. And so that began a journey of just accepting myself and being proud of who I am. And maybe there was some shame that my mother abandoned me. Maybe there was some shame that my father never even knew I existed, because that question's probably out there. My father never knew I existed, and my dad had no idea I wasn't his son. We've asked, literally, in all honesty, and I'm open for every answer. I don't need it to be either, but AJ, you know, did your dad know you? No, he was on my birth certificate and I looked a lot like my mother. You know, I died not knowing. He treated me the exact same way he treated my brother. And I told you we were close. And I actually was thinking about, you know, I knew I was going to talk to you today. And I was thinking this morning, like, I'm kind of so glad I didn't have to tell him.
Yeah.
No, I can only imagine the hurt on his face, you know, to think that, ugh, must be hard. That's a part of my story that I don't have to walk through, that I know a lot of our listeners probably did. And I'm sorry for anybody who had to do that. That was super, super difficult.
I do think it's to use the word wild, crazy. You were essentially raised by two people, and I know you loved your dad. He was your best friend. But you were essentially raised by two people you weren't biologically related to.
Exactly.
That's wild.
It is. Thank you for saying that. Because Now that I'm facing, a few years later, I'm still facing a lot of the fallout from this, like maybe some shortcomings that I have with my emotions and, you know, and I examine how I relate with my wife and things like this. Like, listen, my goal in life is to be the best bloody dad I can be, man. That's my thing. And I can tell you right now that I'm pretty effed up in some ways. What I mean is like connection, trust, like these are things I'm discovering. But no, here's the thing. What you just said is a big part of that puzzle. You know, I never hugged one of my friggin' parents. You know, I'm getting jeans. You know, I get two pairs of Arizonas from JCPenney's right before school started every fall. And when mom, the one I call mom, you know, would tug on the back, it was a discomfort there. You know, there wasn't the mother maternal. I never had it. Never hugged mother and felt safe. And like, yeah, that's a thing. And the same with father. Never looked at father. That whole lion thing I gave you earlier, I didn't have that with him. I never looked at my father and went, that's a man. I was looking at someone else's father going, that's a man. And common sense is sitting in the corner going, it's not nothing. And so I'm left kind of with, and I'm trying to sound like some sort of victim here, but I have to face these things honestly again, because I want my marriage to last. I'm the only one in my entire family that has never been divorced. Not from my birth father's side, but anybody ever grew up with, everybody's divorced. And I'm doing it, man. We're still going. And I know that the route to happiness and the route to longevity in my marriage and a fulfilling marriage and being the father I want to be, it runs through this shit. It just does. I have to face this stuff. So thank you for saying that. You're right. That was not the plan. And I know I'm limited in some ways because of it. And I've just got to keep going. got to keep working and try to get these things healed up inside of me, or, you know, apply some acceptance the best I can. Because like I said, that, you know, at the very least, I got to do this for my kids. And I will tell you this, I am very close with my kids. Like, you know, really, I know other people can say that, but whatever, but I'm really close to my kids. I get to be home with them every day, all day. You know, I don't need breaks from them. I just, they're the center of things. And we're really, I think we've got a real healthy thing going. But like I said, I'm aware, you know, this stuff matters.
I love when I meet another NPE. I'm like this too, where you take parenting so seriously. Maybe it is because of our situation, but I really respect that. And you are a male NPE. I don't hear from nearly as many men as I do women. Have you always been this emotionally aware, intelligent? And what are your thoughts on what can we do to get men to feel more comfortable speaking about this?
Good questions. Yeah. That's one thing I have noticed with the myriad of podcasts and support groups, because I was on a couple on Facebook or was active for a long time. Yeah. One-tenth maybe are men.
Yeah.
You know, and here's the thing. I'll speak from my job, just to say, counseling a lot of people and speak. I just don't think men are given the tools. Now, to give my stepmom credit, this is her communication style. You know, she passed. My mother is a good communicator. My mom, she's a good communicator. She's descriptive. She's talkative. She's inquisitive. I got this from her. So yes, I've always had a verbal acumen. I've always been emotionally aware, more, you know, on that end of things. I always just naturally have, but the credit's to her. But as far as the men go, I would say leading by example. You know, that's one thing I enjoy about my job. You know, I get to sit there in jeans and a flannel at church on Sundays. And I'm the singer, but I'm the one who's preaching and stuff. And I'm just a guy. I'm just a dude. Like, and telling them they have to leave their manliness to the side to belong. Sometimes when it comes to the emotional realm, a lot of men feel like they got to leave their man stuff aside to belong. In other words, sometimes sharing your emotions feels feminine. And that's just straight up bullshit. Forgive my language, but observe strong language, because a lot of men are suffering in silence. And what I would say is this, that I would just encourage any men who've been through this and who can even, you know, don't have to be the most articulate person in the world, but us speaking up gives other people permission to speak up. We're hurting just the same as any woman who ever found out about their fathers or mothers, whatever situation. We're hurting the same way. We're all these little kids, still these little kids grown up. And so I like the opportunity to lead by example, really, to get out there and take the time and say, men, it's okay. And another thing, how can you help men? I literally have a wheel of emotions. It's a colored wheel, and I show it to men. On the inside, it says angry. And over on the right, it says, you know, disrespected or blah, blah, blah. It gets more specific. And I teach men, you're not angry, dude. What are you actually feeling? I'm like, well, I feel disrespected. Exactly. So punching walls is not the right response if you feel disrespected. Now that you realize how you feel, you can react accordingly. Sad, I feel forgotten, I feel invisible. Like, I teach men just to verbalize, to give a title to what they're feeling. And I think a lot of men don't come forward and speak because they don't think they can put titles to how they're feeling. It's amazing how quickly a man can when you start to teach. Mm-hmm. Really, listen, even the men in your life right now, if they're going through something, say, how do you feel? And if they go, I don't know, help them out. Just go, do you feel like disrespected, or are you feeling, you know what I'm saying? And then once he says that, now he knows. It's like a skill. Yeah, that's what this feels like. But nobody's taking the time, because we just don't revere that with men. I'll shut up in a second, but I got a bunch of guys I hang out with. I'm so blessed to have some good men sitting around the table of my life. I think everybody needs to. These people hold me accountable. You know what I mean? They don't let me go off the deep end and destroy my life over stupid stuff. Give me advice, counsel, like I'm that for them, blah, 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 blah. But the thing is, it's not, listen, when we're hanging out, when dudes are hanging out, we don't revere the emotional speech. It doesn't have the value in our circles. Like, oh, Ted's such a good communicator, said no one ever in a guy. You know what I'm saying? So we don't develop the skills because it's not valued. What is valued is tough, useful. Useful is valued in man language. But expressive, that's very rarely valued. That's why I feel like my job is to be, just being so vulnerable with you guys right now, my job is to be what I am, which is a hunter, a fighter, you know what I mean? A weapons guy. I have to be a masculine version of emotional sharing. Because the thing is, people, nobody sitting with me is ever going to go, it's girly to share. Because I say, who are you saying girly? Come on over here. And they'd be like, no, thank you. That's, I have to be both of these things to give them the permission. Because if I was up there in a suit and tie and I was just a little pencil neck or something, they wouldn't relate to that is what I'm trying to say. And I'm not trying to put anybody down. But you see what I'm trying to say?
Yeah, I am.
Say that, no, it does have value in tough culture. And man, it's amazing to see the men in my life that just, I hate to use the word blossom because it's such a feminine, you know, grow and mission, you know? So you can see I'm passionate about that.
Mm-hmm.
This is what I'm giving my life for. It's what I do for a living is go primarily try to help men. Because tell you what, when men step up and when men get the help they need, you get a better husband. You know, society gets better when men get help. And that's, I'm just passionate about that. And if anybody's, you know, triggered by that, understand that 7 out of 10 people that I help are actually the women. So, you know, churches are full of women. And so I spend a lot more time helping the women, just their man that does come or the men that do. I'm real passionate about that.
If people wanted to get in touch with you, would you be open to that?
Yeah, I'd be fine with, an email. Yeah.
Yes. And what is the best email address for you?
My personal address, AJD Alpha Axe Dakota, AJD1139@gmail.com. And honestly, if you really want to look, you could find me talking about this stuff. My stuff gets broadcast on Facebook and YouTube. The church I work at is called Norwood Free Methodist Church. And literally, I've spent the last 3 sermons talking about this stuff, show the wheel of emotions. And I talk to men about how they feel. And I talk to women how lots of times it's insecurity that's steering the ship, but you don't know that it's insecurity. So then we get sarcastic and we get cutting or we shut down, but we don't understand. You're not feeling angry. You're feeling insecure. Get it? Like, I would love for people to get onto the teaching. Mm. Very passionate about the teachings, as you can tell.
Would you send me a link for those as well? The Norwood Free Methodist Church? That would be great. I will add that in the show description down below as well.
I would love that.
AJ, thank you so much for taking the time to share with me. I thoroughly enjoyed this. So thank you so much.
Well, thank you for having me, Lily. And honestly, for all the NPE folks in this community, we would all like to thank you for what you do. You were the first podcast I found. And in my hurting, vulnerable state, I was able to turn them on and listen to other people basically say, me too, me as well, solidarity. And it really helped me. And it was your beautiful voice bringing that help to us all. So thank you for having me on. Thank you for everything that you do. You will never know how many people you've helped, Lily. How many ways. You'll just never know.
These stories are here for us to identify with. If you are an NPE and would like to share your story, email npestories@gmail.com. You do not have to give any identifying information. If you are an NPE and would like to share your story, I'd like to hear from you. Subscribe to this podcast to hear more. Come heal with us.